This is the Nichols-Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January 12, 2015. This podcast is brought to you by Nichols-Patrick CP Incorporated in association with your State Society of CPAs. Any use of the audio of this podcast without the express written permission of Nichols-Patrick CP Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs is prohibited. This podcast is copyright 2015 by Nichols-Patrick CPE Incorporated. We're going to take a look at a few developments that took place over the past week in the area of taxes, and we have a few cases to take a look at this week. We're going to start out first with a case of Peterson versus Commissioner. This is the first Tax Court Memorandum Decision of 2015, TC Memo 2015-1. It was issued on January the 5th. And the issue here involves an attorney and his use of an airplane in his law practice. Now, this attorney was in practice in Southern California, and he purchased a Cessna Turbo Skylane for $332,000 that he claimed he was going to use in his business. Now, due to the expenses of running this Cessna, he actually abandoned an office, independent office, and moved to an office in the home, and therefore flew the Cessna. He actually flew this Cessna to locations that were within an hour's driving distance of his home. He did so, he claimed, to avoid the traffic in Southern California. Now, he claimed, of course, to have over 50% business use, took Section 179 on the plane, and took most of the expenses as a deduction involving his law practice. The IRS disagreed. Now, the good news for the attorney in this case was, yes, he did have records. So this is not one of those cases where you dismiss the case out of hand before we get started because the taxpayer in question had no records to get started with, which often is the case in cases like this. But the problem here was that the court did not find most of his records believable. While he would make notes that he had flown the plane for a business purpose, the court had reason to doubt that that would be true. Only in specific cases, very limited cases, did they find specific reference to things like attending a trial, going for a deposition, meeting with potential witnesses, all those sorts of things that were part of his practice. Rather, quite often he took these flights, and interestingly enough, in many cases these flights would be to areas that otherwise also were resort areas, in which you might assume there might be other reasons why he had flown there. He also had a flight he claimed was for business that went back to North Dakota where his parents lived. He claimed his parents were basically clients of his law practice. Well, one problem we had with the North Dakota trip came down to the fact that he had never actually charged his parents. His parents had never paid anything for him. So whether or not he was representing them as an attorney, the reality was he wasn't in that for making money for his trips to North Dakota. They also had problems with many of his other trips where there was no real background. As well, he included as business trips a lot of trips related to training that he needed and hours he needed to be flying in order to get instrument rated on the plane. He wanted to be instrument rated because he claimed that would enable him to fly in less favorable weather conditions. Now, of course, please remember that this is somebody flying generally in Southern California. So that conceivably got the court a little concerned about whether that was really a business reason, or more likely, which is what the court finally concluded, it was more that he just liked the challenge of being instrument rated. Also, he had various flights for maintenance of the plane. The court concluded ultimately he could only document a far less than 50% business use for the plane. For that reason, the court also found that he could not claim Section 179 because being less than 50% and being listed property, you can't take 179. That would force a recapture of the 179 claimed in prior years. As well, the court found the IRS did not question whether this was an ordinary and necessary business expense. However, the court, in its opinion, strongly suggested that had the IRS questioned that, the court would have found it very difficult to find this as ordinary and necessary. As the court pointed out, he was flying to locations that were within easily a one-hour drive. In fact, that was what the vast majority of flights were. The court simply concluded this was a guy that liked to fly planes, and he was trying to put that in as part of his law practice, even though in reality it had very little to do with actually making money as an attorney. What this points out is, yes, you need the records to get your listed property, but clients also have to understand that you've got to show plausible business trips and plausible business use. You can't just take something, and I don't care what article you read or what buddy told you you could do this, you can't just take something and make it into a deductible business expense just because you'd like to do it, or just because you can come up with some theoretical reason, well, I could go ahead and use this to transfer to travel for business. That didn't quite work in his case, and most of his deductions were disallowed in the case. Next up, a case that probably doesn't directly affect a lot of us, but it did affect a taxpayer in a significant way. This is the case of MoneyGram International and subsidiaries versus commissioner. MoneyGram, you may recognize the name. They are the largest issuer of money orders in the U.S. They also provide the sort of thing like Western Union where they'll directly send funds from point A to point B. They will also provide checks that are effectively guaranteed in payment that are issued by various entities. Now, what MoneyGram generally does is you go down, you want to get a money order, you go down to the store or whatever the organization is that's going to issue the money order to you, you give them the money, they give you back a MoneyGram money order that's issued by them. It may be labeled MoneyGram, it may have the seller's own sort of names, it may be privately branded but still going through the MoneyGram system. That company then holds that money and twice per week forwards all the money it has received to MoneyGram. Now, MoneyGram is regulated in many cases by state banking departments. However, it does not actually set up as a bank in either for federal purposes or for purposes in the states. Secondly, the entity also is not eligible to join the Federal Reserve, nor is it subject to FDIC supervision. Under Section 581 of the Code, a bank is allowed to write off as a bad debt loss securities that otherwise the debt securities that would normally be considered capital loss assets if held by an individual. MoneyGram, back in the 2008 financial crisis, one of the things that the states generally require for money transfer service is that it maintain certain minimum capital amounts and that those capital has to consist of highly liquid assets, including highly rated securities, their short-term securities. During the financial crisis, a number of MoneyGram short-term securities went from being highly rated to being down in a junk status. MoneyGram had to recapitalize, which involved getting rid of a lot of those securities and taking a write-off. They had no capital gains with which to offset capital losses, so they wanted to claim they were a bank. Here's the problem. The tax court said, and this is a published tax court decision, 144 TC number 1. The tax court said that to be a bank, there are two tests under 581. You have to both be a bank and you have to meet the test involved in being a bank, that you have to effectively, the receipts of deposits from the general public, repayable deposits on demand or at a fixed time, it must show you have the use of deposit funds for secured loans and the relationship of debtor and creditor between the bank and the depositor. Now, MoneyGram initially argued that they just had to meet those three tests and they didn't have to show that they would otherwise normally be considered a bank. The court disagreed with that and found that MoneyGram is not what anybody would think of as a bank. But the court also went on and said MoneyGram doesn't meet those tests anyway. MoneyGram had said, well, we accept deposits because people that issue checks that we guarantee, they have to keep money on deposit with us and we settle that up. The court pointed out that in reality, that kind of deposit was one that only affected a small portion of their business. Secondly, the court pointed out that's not really a deposit in the same way that a savings account or a checking account is a deposit. Those funds are put in there to be used to cover checks that are going to be issued, that the entity is going to issue as a guaranteed check. And MoneyGram, having paid out of that, expects to get the money back. And that just covers MoneyGram from that standpoint. It is not money that's put there as investment-type funds that you would put if you're putting money into a savings account with a bank or for safekeeping in a checking account. It's a different type of entity. The court also points out that they did not accept these contributions from the general public. You had to be a MoneyGram customer selling these particular checks, money orders, other documents in order to even be subject to this. The court also pointed out that none of this suggested that in fact they were holding deposits for the customer in this realm the same way as a bank. The court also points out that they didn't really make loans. MoneyGram says, oh yes we do, because when the local convenience store sells a money order, they have money that they owe to us, and so that's a debt to us, so that's a loan from us. The court pointed out, no, that money came from the customer of the convenience store that walked in. It did not come from MoneyGram. MoneyGram did not take money from deposits by which to make loans, which is how we're supposed to be working with this. They also pointed out that we didn't really have a relationship of debtor and creditor between the bank, and even if you counted those financial institutions that had funds on deposit with MoneyGram as customers, it wasn't the same sort of relationship you had with a bank. So MoneyGram had to treat this as a capital loss. And as a corporation, that's bad news because, of course, corporate capital losses can only be offset against corporate capital gains. And while they can be carried back 2 years to find gains, they only go forward 5 years. And if you can't get any capital gains during that period as a C Corp, you lose the capital losses. And quite often, that's the result. In this case, it is extraordinarily likely that MoneyGram would never have enough capital gains during that period to be able to offset the rather large losses they had to take as part of the 2007-2008 financial meltdown. So this was a major loss for them in terms of having to write a nice big check for taxes. Ebert versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-5, deals with a section that is really one everybody should always be aware of, Section 6201D of the Internal Revenue Code. That section provides generally, if a taxpayer, the IRS, as we all know, loves to issue CP2000 letters when they receive notes, when they receive information that there was a 1099 issued to this taxpayer and that amount was not reported on their 1040. Now, the hitch there is the IRS has the right to do that and the right to proceed. However, if the taxpayer cooperates with the IRS and raises a reasonable doubt about whether or not that payment was made, the IRS has to go seek additional evidence, and they have the burden of proof, which is the key aspect here. They have the burden of proof to carry in court. In this case, the taxpayer had Burlington Northern Santa Fe stock, which was being held in this case by a registered agent. The registered agent was registered agent holding the stock. And ComputerShare Investor Services would then issue dividends to Mr. Ebert. But the problem was Mr. Ebert hasn't been receiving his dividends. And apparently had tried to have many communications unsuccessfully with ComputerShare. Well, apparently ComputerShare could communicate with the IRS and send a copy of a 1099 to them, which the IRS then issued the CP2000 notice. When Mr. Ebert complained that he hadn't received it, the IRS did contact ComputerShare, but all they got back from them was a letter claiming that Mr. Ebert had actually been issued a 1099, and therefore he actually had the income. It had a phone number. The IRS forwarded that letter to Mr. Ebert. He's still trying to get his money, by the way. The taxes are kind of a sideshow, so he's trying to get his money back from this enterprise for unpaid dividends. He took that letter, and so he decided to call the number to see what was up, and he discovered that that number only had a recording that offered him no option to talk to a live person to basically straighten out what was in the letter or hopefully even find his money. The tax court told the IRS that letter was insufficient to overcome the burden they had under the provisions mentioned here for Section 6201D of the Code. That they had the burden had not been carried. Therefore, the tax court ruled that Mr. Ebert was not taxable on those dividends shown on that 1099 for that year because the IRS failed to show any evidence beyond the 1099 that he had actually received those payments, and the taxpayer credibly testified that he didn't have them. It is important to note that the court did place a high level of emphasis on the credibility of the taxpayer, in this case, Mr. Ebert. As predicted earlier, Notice 2015-2, the IRS has now officially issued payroll tax relief, a relief for reporting for those businesses that paid for certain transit benefits that retroactively in the Tax Increase Prevention Act of 2014 were reinstated. This is equivalent to the notice back in 2013 we had on a similar point. The key issue here, remember, basically, if the taxpayer has essentially, in those years where the increase in limit, all excludable benefits raised up to 250. That means everything's up at the level of benefits for the parking benefit, the transit benefit, all of those benefits come up to the 250 level. But as many of them had dropped to 130, taxpayers that actually paid employees those benefits during 2014 would include anything above 130 per month in income. If that was true, and so they withheld FICA on those payments and income taxes, here's how it's going to work. The taxpayer, If they have not filed their Form 941, they can simply make a negative adjustment to both Medicare and FICA taxes, including the additional Medicare tax. They must refund the FICA that's been overwithheld to the employee, and they must therefore, and then they can file just this adjusted 941. They do not have to file a 941X for all the prior quarters. If they have issued W-2s to the employees but have not sent them to Social Security, they must simply issue a corrected 1090, a corrected W-2 to the employee, and that'll be the structure and what's required there. If the taxpayer has already filed their 941, or they don't find out about this notice till they do file their 941, then they will have to file a 941X for each quarter to claim the refund. They will also not be able to reduce the payment of additional Medicare tax. As you should be aware from last year, the additional Medicare tax, generally if that's overwithheld, has to be recovered on the 1040 by the employee. While we're allowing a special rule to let us go back and undo the additional Medicare tax if we catch it before filing the fourth quarter 941 and issuing the W-2s, if we've already filed all four quarters of 941s, we use a 941X and we're under the standard rules where the additional Medicare tax now is going to be recovered by the employee on their 1040. Now, the sad part about all of this is the same benefits revert to the same problem January 1st of 15 because Congress did not extend this benefit past the end of 14. While it seems likely Congress may come back and retroactively extend this benefit yet again sometime in 15, for right now, payroll departments have to start withholding on benefits in excess of the limit in 15 and then wait and see if the IRS finally comes back, and not the IRS, should say, but Congress finally comes back and extends it. And if they do, we will probably have a brand new notice to deal with the problem for 15 W-2s that's created by the fact that this item keeps leaving the law. Final thing we're going to discuss today is the estate of Escher versus United States. This is a case in the United States District Court from the Southern District of Ohio. Case number 1:13-CV-00705. Our reference is 2015 Tax Notes Today 5-12 and was issued on January the 6th. This comes back to the basic problem that a taxpayer cannot rely on a professional to file an extension. In this case, the executor of the estate was highly unsophisticated. She had actually never visited an attorney's office before what had been basically her cousin took her in when they were putting together her cousin's estate plan slightly before the cousin died. The cousin appointed this person as executor. She had never visited an attorney before. Her cousin had a $12 million estate primarily consisting of UPS stock, but the executor had never owned stock. And the executor had never previously been an executor for any other estate. So because she realized she didn't know what she was doing, she went ahead and just hired that attorney to handle the estate and work with her. Now, the attorney explained to her that the estate tax return would be due in September of 2009 and explained to her that there were major penalties for not filing on time. Also explained that due to the makeup of the estate, they would have to sell some UPS stock in order to pay the estate tax. The estate tax in question, she was told, was going to be an amount that was in excess of $2 million would be due on the estate. So there was an amount that was kind of, or I should say, in excess of $6 million, estate tax would be due. Well, it turns out the attorney did not tell her this, did not tell the executor this, but it turns out the attorney was suffering from brain cancer at the time. And it appears that this had a significant impact on the attorney's practice. She began missing tons of deadlines. In fact, what happened was she missed, and the executor was told by the probate court in Ohio that she had missed a number of filing deadlines. The attorney then, the executor knew about that September date, but she didn't contact the attorney till after that date to ask about, well, what had happened? I thought we had to file something by then. The attorney told her at that point, oh, no, I'd gotten an extension. Except it turned out the attorney had not. The tax court is not clear whether she intentionally misled the client or this was simply, an unintentional misleading. But in any event, there was no extension filed. Around this time, she also got contacted by another family who had retained this attorney who told her that, this attorney was having big problems. They were going to be terminating her and that she should terminate that attorney. She continued to get notices now eventually from the state of Ohio's tax department about the estate tax return not been filed. She asked, the attorney claimed everything was being taken care of. However, she did hire another attorney to look what was going on. That attorney advised her that she should go ahead and get rid of this counsel and get somebody else. For reasons that aren't clear, she didn't take action then. And only as things began to continue going down the line, and as she got more notices, and as she finally called up UPS, because she had given the attorney the authority to sell stock, papers to allow stock to be sold months earlier, and UPS told her they had no record of ever receiving any document from that attorney that would have ordered a stock sale. Then she finally fired that attorney, hired the one that had told her she should get rid of this attorney, which turns out to have been good advice, and then they went ahead and got the estate tax return filed, but it was late. The estate had penalties of over $1 million due for late filing. The estate claimed that they should be let out of those penalties because they had reasonable cause for late filing, because she believed the attorney had filed a proper extension, and she was unsophisticated and really couldn't know about these things, and obviously couldn't do a 706, so she had to rely on somebody. The district court agreed that she couldn't do a 706, but they said, unfortunately, a whole lot of case law going back to the U.S. Supreme Court holds that the question here is not whether you knew how to do a 706, but did you know how to read a calendar? If you knew the return was due in September of 2009, it doesn't take any expertise to figure out that you have not filed a 709 by that point. It takes no expertise to follow up and make sure if there is an extension that one had actually been filed. You cannot delegate that to a third party. So because of this, the estate was still found to be liable. Now, the estate had gone after the attorney for malpractice, and in fact, the attorney and the estate had settled. Presumably, we don't know whether that settlement had as part of it whether or not the attorney's malpractice carrier or the attorney would have to pay this penalty if the IRS wouldn't relieve it. It's not to know how that will go. By the way, this attorney's problems were so serious that she eventually gave up her law license due to complaints about malpractice. And prior to the trial, it turned out she was later ruled incompetent by the state and had a conservator appointed over her and her assets. So the catch to this, as he basically is pointed out, as unfair as it may seem, this unfortunately is the law. You cannot rely on an advisor to file an extension. This has been the current tax developments for the week of January the 12th, 2015. Be sure to join us next week for more developments on tax matters.